Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show. On KJZZ 91.5 FM in Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, we will take a closer look at American happiness, or lack thereof, and later on, we'll pay tribute to one of the original Taco Bell restaurants in Scottsdale. But first, with the president's so-called Liberation Day tariffs going into effect this morning, nations around the world are reeling. But one country is a relative veteran of the new economic order, and that is Mexico, where President Claudia Sheinbaum has been wheeling and dealing with President Trump for months now. Joining me for a closer look at Sheinbaum's approach to working with our mercurial chief executive is KJZZ's senior field correspondent, Nina Kravinsky, who is based in Hermosillo, Mexico. Nina, good morning. And do we have Nina on the line? Hello, Nina. All right. We are going to see if we can get Nina back on the line in just a moment. You're listening to the show. And actually, I'm sorry, we're going to continue with our next piece this morning, which is that happiness conversation that I mentioned a moment ago. The question is, how happy are we? There are lots of ways to measure that. And it's not always a simple question to answer. The idea of happiness and what makes us happy can vary a lot from person to person. The World Happiness Index aims to get a sense of it, using metrics including healthy life expectancy, generosity, and positive and negative emotions. The most recent report, which takes in data averaged between 2022 and 2024, finds Finland as the happiest country on Earth. The U.S. is ranked 24th. That's the lowest we've ever ranked in the report's more than decade-long history. So clearly, there's a lot to talk about when it comes to happiness.
Happy, baby?
I'm so happy.
Happy!
Happy.
Happy.
Happy!
Do you ever wish that you could just be happier?
I didn't really believe in happiness. I thought that only idiots were happy.
Happiness is not something you find outside of yourself, and it's not something you have or don't have.
I hope you're happy. I hope you're happy now.
Your happiness is enjoyment, satisfaction, and purpose.
Well, this week, we're looking at the issue of happiness and how we impact it. Today, we hear from Dan Horowitz, a cultural historian whose work is focused on consumer culture and author of nearly a dozen books, including 2018's Happier, The History of a Cultural Movement That Aspired to Transform America. When my co-host Mark Brody spoke with him earlier, he asked if there was a turning point where Americans started thinking about happiness and its relative importance in our lives and mental well-being, or if it was something that just kind of evolved over time.
Well, if by Americans you mean general public, I suspect that waxed and waned over decades and depends on whom you're talking about. But in terms of kind of public discussions of the subject, the transformative moment comes in the late 1990s when a psychologist at University of Pennsylvania named Martin Seligman gave a presidential address at the American Psychological Association, and called on his colleagues to stop, maybe stop's too strong a word, but to focus less on negative aspects of people's lives and more positive ones. And that led to, of course, with precedence, but led to a field called positive psychology, which studies the factors that make people have a greater sense of well-being than ill-being, commonly known as happiness.
Well, so how big of a cultural change was that to go to positive psychology from where we had been?
Well, of course, it has precedence deep in American history. The most notable is Reverend Norman Vincent Peale's a book in the early 50s. But it was an enormous sea change. I mean, obviously in history, nothing happens out of nowhere or immediately or at one moment.
Yeah.
But in terms of the kind of organized focus on happiness, It was an enormous moment that had outcomes not only in universities, but in popular culture. You can see this on TED Talks. You can see this on the smiley face that we see around us so much.
Yeah, I'm curious, like, in what ways this new movement made itself known to people, maybe not necessarily people who are seeking this topic out, but just sort of in everyday life. Like, what difference did it make?
Oh boy, that's hard to gauge. But Marty Seligman defined what he was doing as coming at what he called a Florentine moment, where democracy was spreading around the world, where hundreds of millions of people, if not billions were rising out of poverty and hundreds of millions into the middle class. And in the United States, a somewhat an occasional, a more robust sense of a promising future. So it coincides with larger issues out in the society of confidence about the future of America, not something we see a lot of today, but prominent in an earlier period.
Do you yourself have a definition that you use of happiness? Like, how do you gauge it?
Well, people in the field gauge it by, in some cases, really actually trying to measure it with people by giving them pagers or so or a similar instrument and having them record every so often how they're feeling. So some people in positive psychology, I'm of course su suspicious of this, think you could actually measure it in a personal life on a day by day, hour by hour. How do I define it? People in the field don't love the word happiness, in part because it suggests a certain superficiality of emotions. They prefer the term a sense of well-being, psychological well-being, a sense of confidence in oneself, a sense that the world is okay. That they can achieve things, that they can be effective in the world.
It's interesting the idea of relating in some way the concept of happiness to politics, because it seems like at a certain point, and maybe this is that point right now in the world, that what makes some people extremely happy politically makes other people extremely unhappy politically. And it seems like it might be kind of difficult to reconcile that in some way. Like, is this an era of happiness or not, when, maybe half the people are happy with what's going on and the other half are really not?
That's a wonderful question. I think we are at a certain time in American culture where happiness, at least in my view, seems to be, or people seem not very happy. That you could see a lot of this in the rhetoric of the last election. I also think, in a different way from where your question is leading, about the relationship between politics and happiness, in the sense that if you ask the question, what can we do politically? What can we do legislatively or non-legislatively to increase the sense of well-being among people? And on that issue, and I hope you don't mind by going off in this
No,
direction.
please.
Yeah, on that issue, there's a wide range of responses. And on the left is a man, an economist, political economist named Richard Layard, now in the House of Lords in England, who sees it this way, and somewhat the way I see it. It's very clear from studies that once a certain income level is reached, more money doesn't make you happier. And the implication of that study or those studies is income redistribution, tax the wealthy, and develop policies that will support the less fortunate more robustly. At the other end of the spectrum is the work of a man named Arthur Brooks, a conservative who points out that in general, conservatives are happier than liberals, And his policy recommendation is not to rely on the federal government, not to rely on legislation along the lines Layard emphasized, but rather to strengthen family life, to strengthen social connections, to increase liberty and individual freedom.
Well, it seems like what they both agree on, perhaps, is that government maybe can't create or legislate happiness, but it can maybe create the environment in which people can be happy, however you define that, whether it's based on income or whether it's based on being left alone and sort of whatever it is that makes you happy. Like, government can't make that happen, but it can kind of create the environment in which it could.
That's right. I would think on the left, the answer would be more economic. Among conservatives, it would be more cultural. How do you strengthen families? That position or that approach isn't primarily governmental, but it could involve churches, strengthening community, strengthening family, etc.
Dan Horowitz is a cultural historian and the author of several books, including Happier: The History of a Cultural Movement That Aspired to Transform America. All right, and I believe we are now up on the line with KJZZ senior field correspondent Nina Krivinsky in Hermosillo, Mexico. Nina, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Hi, Sam.
Good morning. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So the U.S. trade relationship with Mexico, obviously vital. Mexico was the U.S.'s top trade partner in 2024 with over $800 billion in revenue changing hands between the two countries. To start, Nina, can you set the scene for us? For people who have been listening to the radio all morning and are maybe head swimming with all the countries that are affected in various ways by the tariffs, what are the tariffs currently in place on Mexico and how do they differ from what's in place on other nations?
Yeah, totally. It's a great question. It is all so complicated. you know, Mexico is sort of breathing a sigh of relief this week after, you know, last week and Trump's big tariff announcement. It really wasn't as bad as it could have been for Mexico. You know, Trump's been threatening a 25% across the board tariff on Mexico and Canada for all their goods. And that didn't come to pass last week. And Mexico's also free from this, you know, baseline 10% tariff that Trump put on virtually every other country that the U.S. trades with. You know, but certain sectors in Mexico do still have new tariffs from Trump. Steel and aluminum, for example. And then there's auto manufacturing. That's a really big part of the Mexico-U.S. trade relationship. And a lot of U.S. car makers have their assembly lines here in Mexico. You know, even though there is this free trade relationship between Mexico and Canada and the U.S., at least for now, Trump's tariffs are still sort of throwing a wrench into those automakers' plans here. You know, for example, the U.S. carmaker Stellantis, which makes Chrysler cars, paused operations at one plant in Mexico right after the tariff announcement as it figures out how big a deal these tariffs are going to be for them.
Okay. Well, so from one standpoint, it makes sense that the U.S. would have a very specific relationship with Mexico, given the magnitude of the trade relationship. But no less specific is the relationship between Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum and President Trump. The Washington Post recently called Sheinbaum, quote, the world's leading Trump whisperer. Tell us a little bit about what Sheinbaum's strategy has been in dealing with Trump.
Yeah, it's a great question. So Sheinbaum has been keeping a cool head. That's what she keeps saying, a cabeza fría. you know, she's not reacting as quickly or aggressively as, say, Canada is to you know, happenings in this trade war. You know, Canada announced right away last week, for example, that it would retaliate for Trump's auto tariff with a 25% tariff of its own on U.S. autos. And Sheinbaum hasn't announced anything like that yet. That strategy's paid off pretty well for her with Trump in the past. You know, Mexico has managed to stave off that 25% big tariff that I mentioned since the beginning of the Trump administration, essentially. Trump has responded by saying that he and Sheinbaum have a good relationship. They've both said on social media that they have respect for each other. And, you know, their administrations have a respectful relationship. You know, back in February, Trump was going to slap Mexico with that big, heavy tariff. And then he didn't. After a phone call with President Sheinbaum, in which, you know, that she promised to send 10,000 Mexican National Guard troops to the border.
Yeah, this Cabeza Fría idea is very interesting because, if I'm not mistaken, this was actually a line of attack against her by her opponent in the 2024 presidential race, who called her the Ice Lady. but it seems to be working in terms of her relationship with Trump, at least relative to other countries. How is it playing in Mexico? How is she messaging all of this domestically?
Yeah, people here are really impressed with how she's doing when it comes to Trump. She has really high poll numbers here, up to 80% or higher approval ratings. You know, there's another phrase besides Cabeza Fría that she uses a lot, and it's coordinación sin subordinación, coordination without subordination. That's a really difficult line to walk, right? To not be antagonistic to the U.S. and risk tariffs, but also not seem like a pushover. And she seems to be walking that line pretty well.
That's really remarkable. I want to make sure we don't go past that. Approval ratings in the 80s.
Yeah.
The last we saw, Trump's approval ratings were, of course, underwater here, under that 50% mark. So she seems to be in a pretty strong position as this dynamic situation continues to evolve.
Yeah, totally. And it gives her, you know, sort of leverage to do to carry out domestic policy sorts of thing, goals that she has here. And it's important to note that her predecessor's approval ratings were about 75% when he left office in September. So, you know, it sort of goes with the party that she is coming from as well.
Well, as a last question for you, Nina, let's talk a little bit about whether there's any daylight between Sheinbaum's approach and the approach of the previous Mexican administration. Mm-hmm. What do you make of that? How similar is what she's doing to the former president?
Yeah, so her predecessor is López Obrador. He was Sheinbaum's sort of political mentor, and they have a lot of the same sort of political populist policy goals. But you know, AMLO, as he's known here in Mexico and kind of around the world, was known for being pretty off the cuff. And that vibe played pretty well with Trump, who's also pretty off the cuff.
some would say.
Exactly. You know, so Sheinbaum, so far, as we've talked about, has had more of kind of a professional, level-headed relationship with Trump. But she's also had some important policy differences with her predecessor, AMLO, that have played well with Trump. She's gotten rid of the strategy that he had to deal with cartels. It was called the hugs, not bullets strategy. And it looked to get at the root causes of violence in Mexico rather than to use force. But Sheinbaum's been taking a pretty different approach to drug cartels. She's been highlighting big fentanyl lab busts, and she's agreed to send almost 30 high profile cartel figures to the U.S. to face prosecution on the other side of the border. And, you know, those things have, as you could imagine, played pretty well with the Trump administration. Obviously, in Trump's administration, things can change pretty quickly. People can fall out of favor at the drop of a hat. Yeah. So we'll see where their relationship kind of goes from here.
Yes, lots to watch as that dynamic continues to evolve. That is KJZZ's senior field correspondent, Nina Krivinsky, in Hermosillo, Mexico. Nina, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Sam.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, we'll go back to the American Old West with a game of Cowboy Fast Draw. But first, way back in the social media stone age, I'm talking 2007 or so, a comedian named Grace Helbig started making videos in her apartment and posting them to a newfangled social media site called YouTube. And as hard as it may be to believe, back then, there wasn't much else like this on the internet. Grace, in the videos, played this kind of exaggerated version of herself, a sort of fumbling, overeager 20-something, trying and failing to figure out adulthood. And while she didn't necessarily invent vlogging, before long, she was one of the online creators who was synonymous with that term. She built a following of over 2 million subscribers, got her own TV show, and published best-selling books. And then, about 2 years ago, she was starting to feel burned out by the daily grind of mining her life for content. But just as she was starting to spend less of her life online, life threw her a curveball. Grace was diagnosed with breast cancer. And instead of withdrawing from the internet, she decided to re-engage with it in a different way. She vlogged about her diagnosis and treatment, bringing viewers into her chemotherapy sessions and speaking frankly about the nausea, weakness, and emotional turmoil of recovery.
It's 7:45 a.m. and we're on our way to go meet with the radiologist for the first time and our oncologist and get updated labs. And as I was trying to get into the car this morning, I opened the car door into my face and got my forehead open. I was holding a bunch of stuff in my hands, a tea, a water, a bag full of all the things I think I need when I leave the house. My minimal amount of eyelashes caused my eyes to fill with water as soon as I get out in the cold air. And when I opened the car door, I had no awareness physically of how close I was to the car door, and I opened it directly into my forehead. And the top of the car door just scraped across my forehead, and Elliot just said, "Oh, baby, you're bleeding."
Perhaps most movingly, she also shared the video of herself ringing a ceremonial bell at the conclusion of her radiation treatment and then going to Cheesecake Factory for a celebratory dinner with her husband.
Yeah, you're going to read that out loud and then ring the bell three times.
Okay, the good luck bell. Ring this bell three times well. It's told to clearly say, my treatments are done, the course is run, and I am on my way.
Did you guys want a photo?
There's only one sensible place to go after you ring the bell at radiation.
The Cheesecake Factory.
These days, Grace is feeling much better, and she's now on tour with a show about her cancer journey called Let Me Get This Off My Chest. The show comes to Phoenix tomorrow night, and I caught up with Grace recently to talk about the evolution of her online and stage personas.
There's such an emphasis in content creation on engagement of, like, within the first 3 seconds, do something very jarring that gets people's attention, or rage bait or something. And I've been trying to think about for myself the impact of the content. If that has meaning for people, that's more valuable to me than the virality of the content. And I'm not looking for a million views on a vlog about getting a lumpectomy. I'm looking to show my experience so that people in the future that are going through it or know someone going through it might be comforted by what they've seen me do or not do and be able to have a better experience themselves.
Yeah. You know, I have to say, Grace, this makes me think of something that you said to me once a long time ago before your diagnosis and that I have not been able to get out of my head since then. You said,
no.
No, it's a great thing. It's a beautiful thing.
Okay.
But you were talking about living your life on the internet and that there was this important thing you wanted people to keep in mind, which was that things like YouTube and Instagram and TikTok and Snapchat and all these things are called platforms for a reason, that they're supposed to support you. You're not supposed to support them. Mm-hmm. And it was so wise. And I have really, it reframed my entire sense of understanding of social media.
I can't believe I said that.
Well, it just strikes me as you said that to me before you had this diagnosis, and it's almost like you spoke into being this life experience that you are now going through that affirms that wisdom in a way.
Yeah, I just felt this weird compulsion to be like, I have to share this with people. The thought crossed my mind of, I can keep this all offline for myself and maintain my privacy around this diagnosis, but I just felt so compelled to share something so real, and it benefited me two ways, that I didn't feel so alone going through the experience of it. And I gleaned so much invaluable information from viewers that messaged me about, like, tips and tricks and things to get and ways to combat side effects that I would probably not have found out for myself otherwise. And I felt very supported. I've never used YouTube like this before.
Huh.
And this feels like a really great way to use this. This is incredible.
Right. Imagine it actually being a public good.
I know. I was like, man, people should use this for good more often. This is, it feels really good to do that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so that makes me want to ask you then, obviously we're talking today because you're bringing your live show based on all of this to Phoenix. Talk a little bit about the creative decision to take the stories that you were telling off of YouTube and onto a stage and in front of an audience and to make it part of a coherent show? What was the impulse to do that, and how has it been for you?
So this is a chronicle of some of the best and worst times that I had during my breast cancer experience and how my longstanding experience as a social media influencer, for lack of a better word. I hate saying that word.
If anyone has earned it, Grace, it's you. If anyone has earned it, it's you.
Content creator. How that sort of unexpectedly helped and showed up in ways that I wasn't prepared for throughout the experience. So I think there's a lot of sincerity in this show that might not translate as sincerely in a YouTube video or an Instagram reel or
right.
something like that. So
right.
I think there is more of an ability to have emotional peaks and valleys that I don't know would be as impactful in video form.
Do you like that as a performer? Because I know this is something that you've thought a lot about.
Oh my God. I'm like, I have to emotionally prepare for it that I, that's the work I haven't entirely done. So, you know, being sick takes so much of your freedom away that as soon as I got it back, I was like, get me out there. All I want to do is make people feel good if I can. Because that's all I wanted people to do for me.
But does it make you feel good to make other people feel good about it? Because I have to say, one of the most moving things that I heard you say in all the videos you made about this, and there were many, but you were talking about coming out of treatment and that all of a sudden you were presented with this vast amount of space to breathe. Yeah. And that you get stuck in that moment between, oh my God, I can finally go out and engage with people and, you know, actually really connect. And also at the same time, I just want to melt into my couch and not do anything.
Yeah. And a lot of people had kind of quietly and subtly warned me that one of the harder times is post-treatment. And that a lot of people don't really talk too much about that open space that happens after treatment, and that time that it takes to learn what your new body feels like and to trust it and to trust the world with your body in it and to really feel like you have autonomy again. And that is a very bizarre and kind of non-linear sort of path to get yourself back onto. And like, I'm an introverted people pleaser kind of person. And so the internet was like this perfect cross section of all of my interests. Like, I got to entertain people from the privacy of my own home. And then when I got feedback that the audience was also introverted and that this space was safe for them as well, and then suddenly we're all not alone because we all have this shared sort of life experience or emotional sort of dysregulation that we're all trying to figure out. And the same thing with being sick is such an isolating experience, and to be able to put it online and have such feedback from people that are going through the exact same thing or had or knew people that were, was so helpful.
Can I ask you about that introvert element of your personality? And 'cause something that you also spoke about in that that same conversation where you dropped the knowledge about platforms is you were also talking about way back when you first started performing, doing improvised comedy on stage in New York, a sense of before those shows getting so anxious that you would like physically shake.
There is this hope when you get like a diagnosis like that, that you're like, okay, well, I guess the good part of this is that I'm going to come out on the other side and I'm going to be like, screw it. I can do anything. Right. Nothing fazes me. I'm not scared of anything because I almost died. So what do I have to lose? And that's not entirely true. I remember finishing treatment and it being like, you ring the bell and then you're like, ta-da, I did it. Oh, no. What do I do now? Oh, no.
It's still me.
I'm still in this weird new body. Okay. And so I will absolutely be nervous, but it is a nervousness that is absolutely fueled by excitement and eagerness.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and if the anxiety is not going to go away, the source of the anxiety shifting from fear to eagerness, that sounds like progress to me.
Win-win. I'll take it.
Grace Helbig performs her solo show, Let Me Get This Off My Chest, tomorrow night at Stand Up Live. Well, it is the end of an era in Scottsdale. This Friday, one of the original Taco Bell restaurants, complete with its mission-style architecture and vintage striped trash cans, will close its doors. Taco Bell fans all across the country are mourning the location's demise. When it opened back in the 1960s, it was just the 31st Taco Bell location. Today, there are over 8,000. Joining me now to talk about the legacy of Taco Bell locations like store number 31 is Gustavo Arellano. He's a columnist for the LA Times and the author of Taco USA, How Mexican Food Conquered America. Gustavo, good morning.
Gracias.
So, Gustavo, I discovered this morning that Taco Bell superfans call themselves Taco Bellians. Were you aware of this?
Who on earth is a Taco Bell fan? Obviously enough people that they call themselves something as silly as Taco Bellians. And it's funny for me because, you know, here in Southern California, you grew up with Taco Bell, and the rivalry of fast food chains, is it Taco Bell or a smaller chain called Del Taco? I think there's some Del Tacos in Arizona. I'm
oh,
not
yes.
sure.
Yes, we've got
okay,
Del Taco.
Okay, so yeah, so then you folks know what's up. Del Taco is superior, but Del Taco does not have the cult of Taco Bell. So my respect to the fans, my respect to the company. And this is why something like the closing of a location, an original location like in Scottsdale, is making so much noise, so to speak, and drawing in all these pilgrims who want to go there, want to get their Enchirito Crunch Wrap Supreme or whatever they offer now before it's too late from the OG, one of the OG spots out in the valley.
Yeah, Taco Bellians or pilgrims, perhaps. I should say this show officially has no position in the great debate between Del Taco and Taco Bell. But let's talk a little bit about how that cult was developed. A lot has been made of this Taco Bell 31's mission-style architecture, the stucco walls, the clay roof tiles, the archways. Of course, for folks who don't know, Taco Bell was not designed and built by a Mexican person. It was Glenn Bell, who originally founded the chain. How accurate would you say that architectural vision that he had was to actual Mexican taco culture back in the 60s?
It absolutely was not, but it was 1,000% accurate to the imagined truth of what the American Southwest was at this point. So that style of architecture, the arches, the faux adobe, the clay roofs, everything that you described, and also just being very small, it's what's called Spanish Revival, and more specifically ties into something called the Spanish Fantasy Heritage. This is a historical trend, or really psychosis, written best by the author Carrie McWilliams, where across the American Southwest, of course, it used to be part of Mexico, it gets conquered by the United States. Up through the war, the Mexicans and the native Mexicans were described as ugly, as disgusting, as necessary to be vanquished. But then a few decades later, all of a sudden, the Anglos who came in, they're like, oh, well, you know, the Mexicans back then, they had it easier. It was always about fiesta. It was always about party. It was always about this great, great food. So you had architecture and also the rise of Mexican food to try to match that nostalgia of a Mexico that really never existed except in the minds of these Anglos. And so Taco Bell is perfect. Those Taco Bell locations, at least the original ones, are perfect in encapsulating that psychosis.
Hmm. Well, speaking of what you were just referencing there, Gustavo, in the coverage, at least that I've seen about this location closing, a lot of the nostalgia for Taco Bell has come from white people. Joel McHale, for example, said that every brick of the restaurant should be put in the Smithsonian. I'm sure he's just being facetious, but what do folks you've talked to in the Mexican culinary community make of things like the Crunchwrap Supreme or Doritos Locos Taco? Are there Mexican-American Taco Bellians as well?
Oh, God, yeah. My cousins, for that matter, they swear by the Crunchwrap Supreme. They swear that Taco Bell is better than Del Taco. And it's not actually bad Mexican food. Yes, there has been much hay about how Taco Bell is all over the world, but just has never been able to land even one successful restaurant in Mexico. That's never going to change. What's interesting to me, at least from Southern California, and also just looking on social media, okay, maybe the people who are going to the one in Scottsdale or mourning the loss of that Scottsdale location are older white folks, older gabachos who grew up eating there. That's one thing. But the fan base for Taco Bell nowadays is very much diverse, very much like hipster, hip hop, all of that. It is very much attuned to that TikTok culture. That's what's, and that to me is what's so incredible about that Taco Bell story, because you have like the older, like, you know, Taco Bell is of that generation of here in Southern California would be like El Torito's. Out in the Phoenix area, you would have like your Macayos, like those sit down places that was specific for a certain generation, but it never evolved with the times. And so that type of Mexican food is on its way out. Taco Bell never has never been a museum piece. They have always been evolving. They've always kept up with culture. And they, I mean, whoever their advertising or their ad people are absolute geniuses. They should be in the Smithsonian, because everything, everything from, you'll remember the April Fool's joke in the 90s where Taco Bell offered to buy the Liberty Bell, which created so much chaos to the Yo Quiero Taco Bells. They're absolute geniuses on this. So then in recent years, Taco Bell has started to embrace its own history. The very first Taco Bell location.
I'm so sorry, Gustavo, I'm so sorry. We're actually out of time. I know there's much more to explore here, but we'll pick it up with you another time. That is Gustavo Arellano. He is a columnist for the LA Times. Gustavo, thank you so much.
Taco Bell.
Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. And since I moved here from New York, one of the biggest cultural differences I've encountered in Arizona is the culture around guns. So last summer, in an attempt to get a deeper understanding of things, I woke up early on a Saturday morning and drove up to an event at the Pioneer Living History Museum. I got there just in time for roll call.
Bad Burrow! Big Bad John! Desert Dingo.
Here.
Desert Gator.
Here.
Detox.
Here.
Dog Boy. Oh. Double D.
Here.
Ghost Rider.
Here.
Gray Wander.
Here.
Gutshot Garth.
Here.
Half Cock Willie. Heartbreaker.
Yep.
Iceman.
Here.
Moonshine Jack.
Yo.
No Angel.
Here.
Daisy. No Daisy. Yep.
By 8 a.m., with everyone accounted for, the crowd's attention turned towards a dirt path leading to a clearing where there was an antique cannon with a freshly lit fuse.
Listen up!
Listen up! Everybody still here? Good. All right, so, anybody that's sitting down there by that cannon, it's going off and it's gonna be loud.
Woo!
Thank you, Patrick.
And with that, the statewide competition of the Cowboy Fast Draw Association was officially underway. An older man in a wide-brim hat stepped up to a microphone and introduced himself as Quick Cal.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
What I've got for you this morning is more than words just of encouragement. It's words of wisdom.
The crowd pressed in close. Everyone was wearing authentic Old West attire. Boots, leather vests with tassels, leather chaps, flowing skirts, and corsets.
This is your sport as much as it is mine. So, God bless you all. Shoot well today.
Somebody rang a bell, and Desert Dingo, Half Cock Willie, Gray Wonder, and the rest of them hustled over to a bulletin board, spurs jangling and holsters swinging from their hips. They were looking to see which bracket they'd be shooting in. I caught up with Gutshot Garth. He was feeling excited. Things had gone pretty well for him at the last statewide shoot.
I won a first place here in the A bracket, and then I won a second place last week in the B bracket. It's kind of like consolation prize for losers, but I'm competitive.
No, I was remembering that from our conversation last time, that you're here to win.
That's right. Yeah, but you know, it's just part of it. It's part of life.
I first met Gutshot Garth a few months earlier. His given name is Matthew Garth Giesling.
I come by being a gunfighter, honestly. It's definitely in my blood.
Matthew's dad was also a fast draw shooter. In fact, he was at a competition the day Matthew was born. When they brought him to the hospital to meet his son, he was still carrying the 2-gallon jug of Jack Daniels he won at the shoot.
My mom wanted to name me Matthew, and my dad, being a couple of sheets to the wind, took advantage of the situation and named me Matthew Garth. And Matthew Garth is the character in Red River with John Wayne, Montgomery Clift's character.
We were sitting in Matthew's dining room with his wife, Deborah. Deborah started going to the shoots to hang out with Matthew. But before long, one of the other shooters offered her a private lesson.
And so I did it just for fun,
that as soon as I tried it, I was hooked. And I turned around, my husband was standing behind me, and he had already bought me a gun. Everybody in the group.
So you were waiting for this.
They were priming me.
Deborah is just as competitive as Matthew. So competitive, in fact, that she says they can't play board games together anymore. But they don't need board games. They're gunfighters now. Fast draw, to be clear, doesn't involve actual fighting. It's an individual sport. You load a revolver with bullets full of wax and stand in a line of fellow shooters facing a row of metal targets with a red light in the center. When the light comes on, you draw your weapon and fire at the target. If you miss, you don't get any points. But if you hit the target, a judge measures how much time it took for you to draw, fire, and hit. The fastest time wins. So it was the opportunity to spend time together, doing something that Matthew really loved, and the competition that
sealed the deal.
Okay. And the fact that we dress in character. Uh-huh. Yeah.
our youngest son calls it cosplay for adults.
Okay.
And I mean, we all have aliases.
Yes.
Oh, really?
And,
okay.
And Deborah's is Arizona Mama Bear.
And who are you?
My alias is Gutshot Garth. And the reason why it's Gutshot Garth is...
I knew it was going to come to this.
Yeah. I have been shot 3 times when I was 17 years old, and I lived.
May I ask about the circumstances of the shooting?
Yeah, 3 men tried to rob me and murder me.
Oh, my God.
I was not a good person. I had lost my mom when I was 15 and left home at the age of 15. There were a lot of things that were in my life that I wish I had never done. Mm-hmm. And back in the late 70s and early 80s, there was a lot of stuff flowing across the border. And so I was part of that. And just dealing with alcohol and drug addiction and stuff like that. Don't be sorry. I wouldn't be the person that I am today if that hadn't happened.
Sure. After Matthew got shot, he was rushed to the hospital, where doctors thought he was dead. After literally dozens of surgeries, he somehow got back on his feet, met Deborah, and became a Christian. He says he doesn't recognize the person he was back when he got shot. Did getting shot change your relationship or your perspective on guns?
No, absolutely not. My father really inbred in me that you either have evil intentions or you have good intentions, and you have honorable intentions.
Matthew and Deborah, it turns out, have a lot of honorable intentions.
We serve families who are affected by serious mental illness. Our son has a serious mental illness, and he's been in the system, the adult system, for about 14 years. It's a very broken system.
During the day, Deborah runs a nonprofit that helps families like hers navigate the challenges of finding care for adults like her son. That's where she got her FastDraw alias, Arizona Mama Bear. Matthew's day job funds the nonprofit, and he also leads a faith-based discussion group for families affected by mental illness. They love their work, but the demands of their work are a big part of why they love FastDraw.
I do think that us doing this together at this time in our life, I think it's been God's mercy that everything we've been through with our son, especially, that we're together in it, and it drew us closer, where it's very common to hear marriages fall apart in these kind of crisis situations, and ours didn't. It was the opposite. And I think that was, again, God's grace to us. And then to me, this is just another, we've just done everything together really well since then.
When I go out and do Fast Draw, I can blank out the world and there's nothing else happening around me. But my wife's right there with me, and we can forget the cares of the day for those few hours of just peace.
Those feelings of escapism and peace are part of the kinship Deborah and Matthew feel with the people they shoot side by side with.
We all know each other by our aliases. Most of us don't even know our real names. We just call each other Arizona Mama Bear, whatever. We all have a similar kind of the story that we were sharing with you, and I think everyone has a difficult thing they've walked through, or maybe they're walking through. And when we're all there, I think it's not spoken or said, but we all are kind of leaving that behind.
After the break, we'll get to know some of Matthew and Deborah's fellow gunfighters. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. And before the break, I told you I was about to meet some of Deborah and Matthew's fellow gunfighters. The first one we're going to meet is named Apple Pie. Hey, I'm Sam.
Hey, Sam.
Are you Apple Pie?
I am.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. You have these other names out here. We've got names like Venom and Widowmaker and Gravedigger. You know, these are all angry names. And then you got Apple Pie, you know.
Apple Pie is one of those aliases Deborah and Matthew were telling me about. After we spoke in their kitchen, they invited me to a practice shoot in a dusty field at Rio Salado Sportsman's Club in Mesa at the foot of Usury Mountain. They'd set up a shooting line and targets, and club members took turns firing off practice rounds.
Line's ready.
Okay, here come your commands. Shooters on the line. Shooters, set. Somebody hit the pole. No time across the board.
It was dusk, and the air was filled with purple clouds and gun smoke. Between rounds, Apple Pie told me how he got his alias.
That was a military name. When I signed up, I was young little 17-year-old. When I reported in, he says, you look like you should be at home selling mom's apple pie.
When I asked Apple Pie what he likes about Fast Draw, his voice started to quiver.
We're all represented.
Yep.
And you might be shooting against a Purple Heart or an 8-year-old. You never know. That's what we call the luck of the draw. It's a bond, you know. It's we've got a lot of camaraderie out here.
As I was talking to Apple Pie, Deborah came over and stood quietly next to me. There was a twinkle in her eye. When Apple Pie excused himself to load his revolver, Deborah asked if I wanted to try shooting a few rounds.
Are you going to try it?
Yeah, well, why not? Sure. All of a sudden, I found myself being fitted with a holster. A guy who introduced himself as Mule Train handed me a revolver and showed me how to pull it out, cock the hammer, and pull the trigger. Someone handed me a safety release form. As I leaned down to fill it out, it occurred to me that until that moment, I'd never even held a gun, let alone fired one.
Have an alias, want to make one up, or you can just use your regular name and put it over there.
I could make up an alias?
Yeah, sure. Sure can.
I'm frozen. I don't know what to choose.
Yosemite Sam.
Sold.
Put Yosemite Sam or whatever you're doing there.
I stepped up to the line and squinted at the metal target with the red light in the center. I tried to remember all the steps I'd just practiced. Mule Train could see my wheels turning. He leaned over my shoulder and whispered in my ear, "Don't aim." The light turned red and I heard a popping sound.
There you go, nice.
I hit it, right?
Yeah.
Oh my God. I didn't remember drawing or firing, but when I looked over at the target, there was a tiny wax dot near the middle. I turned to Matthew.
I get it.
I told you, it's like cocaine, dude. It's like you just got to do it again.
And I did. In fact, I shot a few more rounds that night. Before I knew it, a couple hours had gone by.
Yep.
And as I walked out to the parking lot, it happened. For the first time in months, ever since I packed up my life and moved to Arizona, 2,700 miles from my fiancé and my life back east, I felt this unmistakable sense of peace.
I just walked out here into the parking lot. It's dead quiet except for the pop of the guns. There's saguaros everywhere. Sunset is purple. I am surrounded by these magnificent peaks. And earlier today, I was so stressed out. I was thinking about the wedding. I was thinking about my friendship with I was thinking about money. And all I was thinking about for the last 2 hours was just dropping into this. And when I was shooting, when I did it the best, it was just look at the target, don't think. and I feel so much more at ease now than I did when I got here. And I haven't felt that way in a long time.
A few months later, when I got to the state shoot at Pioneer Living History Museum, I wanted to tell Matthew how good I felt that day after practice. But I was nervous. The things I'm going through felt so insignificant compared to what he and Deborah are dealing with every day. After my first conversation with Matthew that morning, when he told me he wasn't interested in any consolation prizes, I lost track of him and Deborah. So I wandered around for a while, watching gunfighters take the line. One group was playfully squabbling about a defective target. The judges were concerned that it was registering hits even when shooters missed the mark. "It's just sensitive," one of the shooters yelled. The judge shouted back.
"Ain't no sensitivity in fast draw."
A few yards away, a solitary shooter was leaning against a fence with a harmonica, playing Lowrider. When I finally bumped into Matthew again, I took a deep breath and told him I'd been reflecting on the whole don't aim thing. I told him how comforting it had been to spend a few hours as Yosemite Sam instead of regular Sam. And I told him how silly I felt comparing those feelings to the power of fast draw in his life. When I finished, Matthew just grinned.
This is very different. It's very personal, you know, because this is you. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
He took out his phone and showed me a playlist he listens to when he's getting ready to shoot. One of the songs he added recently is called Jesus Saves by Cooper Allen. It's a song about embracing your imperfections. Early in the song, Cooper Allen sings, "I ain't a Sunday morning choir. I'm a dirty boots in the back pew backslider. I ain't easy to love, more washed in the whiskey than washed in the blood."
And he's just like, yeah, that's me. I'm that, you know, dirty boot center sitting in the back row.
I know.
More washed in the whiskey than I am the blood. It's because this is a work in progress, and I'm just not completely there yet. I don't know anybody who's completely there yet, but I want to be.
Ain't no sensitivity in fast draw? I respectfully disagree. For KJZZ's The Show, I'm Sam Dingman.
That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.